This is ESPN Chicago, WNVP, WTBC, HD2 Chicago,
a Good Karma Brands radio station.
This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago. Now here's your host, Connor McKnight.
Good afternoon and welcome in to White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. I'm Connor McKnight. Celebrate 125 years of White Sox baseball and lock in a 2025 ticket plan today. Be here for the biggest matchups, exciting new promotions, and opening day on Thursday, March 27th. Plus, get access to the best seats at the best value, flexible payment plan, savings on single games, and more. To secure your ticket plan, visit whitesox.com/2025. Well, welcome in, everybody. The White Sox have, you know, made a couple of headlines here over the last week, week and a half. Of course, last week's show, we talked a lot about the new hire of White Sox manager Will Venable. He actually met the media twice now, once over a couple of Zoom calls. We brought you a lot of audio from that introductory press conference in last week's show from Chris Getz and from Will Venable. But on Friday, yesterday, the White Sox had a media availability with Venable and Getz for the first part of the afternoon, first part of the morning, I should say. And then Venable went ahead and did a couple of one-on-one interviews with a bunch of different reporters and broadcasters, including myself. So a little bit later on in the show, we'll have White Sox manager Will Venable on in just a little bit. That's coming up right about 1:15 or so. Venable is probably the biggest headline for the White Sox right now. But there are some kind of like subheads here, some that have been completed and some that we're still kind of waiting on and some that are, you know, obviously going to become major headlines here in the next coming weeks that'll shape the future of the franchise. I'm, of course, talking about the potential of trading Garrett Crochet, which has been long rumored and much reported, and we'll get into it a little bit here on the show. And I actually asked Will about that yesterday, and you'll hear his answer in just a couple of minutes. Suffice it to say that while the White Sox continue to build out the organization from a whole lot of different angles, it's very much, you know, building the groundwork, the foundation of a franchise the way Chris Getz in his front office wants to see it. And, you know, just kind of in thinking back to the press conference that the two of them, Getz and Venable, did last week, that we played some of for you, and then again yesterday, it just, what the two of them did is kind of underline the fact or underscore the fact that they are working together as partners here. And while Venable will obviously be responsible primarily for the 26 guys on the roster on any given day during the major league season, there are certainly going to be all sorts of different aspects of the franchise that Venable has a say in, along with Chris Getz, Brian Bannister, Josh Barfield, Paul Yanish, you know, all the guys that have now become part of the White Sox coaching staff slash front office. And I really do think that more and more with the White Sox and certainly across baseball, we're starting to see coaches have kind of that slash role or at least slash background, right? Front office slash coach. And I think that's a good thing. I think we went through decades of baseball, I think plural, where the front office became fairly numbers oriented. I'm just speaking generally. I'm not talking about any one franchise. And the White Sox would actually probably be one of the exceptions to this generalization. But we saw it where front offices got pretty numbers oriented. The scouts kind of got pushed aside to one way. And it wasn't exactly like Moneyball, right? It's not like an Aaron Sorkin movie necessarily. But there were instances of it across the league and over the last, you know, 10, 20 years or so, 15, 20 years. Anyway, it more and more to me feels like front offices and coaching staff are trying to meld the whole thing together. And the White Sox did add one more brain that will be part of the melding. Ryan Fuller has been hired as the director of hitting for the White Sox. And if that sounds familiar, good. Brian Bannister is the director of pitching for the White Sox. And that move going into last season was pretty widely regarded as as a really smart and interesting move that Chris Getz in the front office made. Bannister was a highly touted guy who had done the kind of analytics, biomechanic coaching, melding thing. I'm using that word again, but there we go. With a lot of pitchers in the Boston Red Sox organization and in other spots prior, the Giants, and really gotten some good results. And the hope is that Fuller and his, hitting infrastructure can do something of the same here. Fuller comes on, again, not as the new hitting coach for the White Sox, although, given the press conference yesterday, Chris Getz mentioned Marcus Thames by name a couple of different times, and while the White Sox have not announced what coaches, if any, and it certainly sounds like there will be some familiar faces, will be returning to the coaching staff in 2025, it certainly sounded yesterday that Marcus Thames is being considered as part of the group right now. I believe I heard that correctly, and I think we've seen it written in some other places as well. That seemed like the first time I'd heard that said by White Sox front office members, Chris Getz specifically. So just a little bit of news there, or at least in between the lines reading that we're doing that kind of can make it feel like news. So let's talk a little bit about Fuller, right? Fuller hooked up with the Orioles in 2019 after working as a high school coach and teacher from 2013, which was the end of his minor league career. He played 1 year in the minors and then got into coaching and was a minor league, a high school hitting coach and high school teacher, God bless him, from 2013 to 2019. Worked in a lot of different spots, traveling circuits and, different hitting clinics and things like that. And I kind of got into the bloodstream in that way. He was hired as a minor league hitting coordinator in 2019 for the Baltimore Orioles, kind of a roving hitting guy, one of those coaches. And in 2021, was promoted to the AA hitting coach and hired as the major league hitting coach or a co-hitting coach at the major league level in 2022. He left after this season. A report from the Baltimore Banner actually said that he, Fuller, chose to part ways with the Orioles after the year. That team, as impressive of an offensive squad as they are, had some offensive issues in the second half of the season compared to the team's first half of the season. And that seems to be the reason that the Orioles, Fuller, and the other co-hitting coach, Matt Borgschulte, who's a fantastic name. Borgschulte is not a thing you get to say a whole lot on the air. So here we go. Matt Borgschulte was the other guy. Anyway, they chose to reorganize some things a little bit. Fuller and Borgschulte either did not choose to come back, weren't asked to come back, maybe a mutual breakup or something like that. Wouldn't be surprised. But the team, the Orioles last year, pre-All-Star break, had a 765 OPS, the second best number in baseball in the pre-All-Star schedule. Post-All-Star break, the OPS team-wide dropped to 731, which was still 11th best in baseball. They had some average issues. They hit like 240 as a team in the second half of the season and had some serious troubles with runners in scoring position. But 731 OPS in the second half of the season would have been the 10th best OPS in all of baseball had they done that all year long. And it was 120 points or so higher than the White Sox all year. The entire season, the White Sox OPS was right around 608 or something like that. And the Orioles at 731 were a whole lot better in the second half when they were considered very bad relative to what the Orioles' expectations were. There's a lot been written about the Orioles' infrastructure here over the last couple of years. We're going to talk about one of the articles that I read just a little while ago that has been kind of linked and thrown around a little bit here. But we're not done with Matt Borgschulte. Borgschulte actually got hired by the Twins almost immediately after he left the Orioles. So both guys, Ryan Fuller and Matt Borgschulte, are well considered and did not have a whole a really tough time finding other jobs in Major League Baseball, which I think is indicative of a couple of different things and a good sign for the White Sox. Fuller's 34, and this job is different than his last job, and it's different than Borgschulte's. All right, that was for me. That's what it was. He's the director of hitting. So the idea here is to system-wide tweak and fix and develop. And it's been pointed out over the last few days, this article that I mentioned, Britt Grioli and Eno Saris, that were reporting late last year, on how the Orioles revamped their entire hitting infrastructure and how Fuller was very much in the mix of that revamping. Part of the organization's new structure was hiring something like 60 to 65, I forget the number, new people, coaches, analysts, R&D people, all over about a year and a half. Mike Elias, the general manager there, really leaned into staffing up. And whether or not that's going to be something that Fuller recommends to Getz and the White Sox is going to be, well, it's yet to be seen. You know, hiring 65 people over the next 18 months, that seems to be what the Orioles had done, it would be insane and something not insane like that's dumb or anything like just like crazy to see. That's not something franchises do very often. And it's certainly not something the White Sox have leaned into at this point. 60 to 65 that's on a high end of the scale, but maybe it'd be interesting to watch. But what this is, hopefully, as a hire, is something where Fuller and his team, whoever that ends up being, can better identify the types of hitters the White Sox have already in the bigs and in the rest of the system and the types they don't, and find ways to acquire those, mold those, and deploy them in the bigs. The hitting side of the White Sox organization, as you likely know, is way behind the pitching side at this point. And Fuller and the rest of his, you know, his team is going to be given a pretty big task to create a whole lot out of not much there at this moment. And that's not to say that there aren't, you know, good and interesting hitting prospects for the White Sox like Colson Montgomery and Edgar Caro and Brian Ramos and, you know, the list goes on, Caleb Bonimer and that kind of thing. But there's not many of them. I think you might say it's a top-heavy kind of thing. And even at the top, you know, with the season that Colson Montgomery had, his success in the Arizona Fall League this last month and a half or so notwithstanding, there's some questions there, and those are all fair. One of the things that this article, and I recommend you go read it in The Athletic if you have the subscription, one of the ways that Fuller, the new White Sox director of hitting, helped create a system for the players there at AA was in meeting them where they lived, right? That's something that they've talked about in this article. Players were graded on swing decisions, and that in and of itself isn't unique to the Orioles. This happens in a lot of places, but the way that their grades on swing decisions were given to them seemed different. Players were texted the results of their swing decisions for the night. Not, again, what's a swing decision? It's not the contact. It's not the results. It's not did you go 4-for-4 with three doubles and a homer or anything like that, although I would imagine that if you did, you're probably ending up with a good swing decision score after all. And you're not even necessarily downgraded on swinging and missing. It's did you swing at a good pitch and was it a good pitch for you, right? That's the other part of a swing decision. You know, swinging at a, you know, neck-high fastball might be good for one type of guy. It's not good for another type of guy. I picked an extreme pitch there. I'm not sure why. That probably doesn't help much, but I think you get the point. So what was there was like a five-star system, and it's something that one of the players, Ryan O'Hearn, said was like a Yelp score for your night, right? Like after the night, you get a scoring on how many, on the swings that you took, probably some of the swings that you didn't take, right? I mean, if you let one down right down the pipe, then you're probably getting downgraded on a bad swing decision, a no swing decision. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we as broadcasters and writers write about when we say the coaches need to make the analytics accessible to players. It's not just did you plop the report down on their chair in their locker or whatever. It's are you getting this information to these players in a way that they can read it, will read it, and will kind of think about it on their own, right? Or at least understand how they want to or don't want to mold that into their game. I think that's really important. And you know, if you say, boy, it's their job, why are they not reading these things, or all this other kind of stuff, what you're forgetting then is kind of the human element of this game, right? We talk about this, we use that phrase for a lot of different places in baseball, but having been an English teacher for a little bit, coaching isn't that much different than teaching. And at the end of the day, and especially for like, you know, AA players, right, in some instances, you're dealing with high school kids at AA. In most instances, you're talking about 20, 21, 22, and 23-year-olds. But even still, like, I don't need to be judged on my behaviors as a 22-year-old. I was a little more advanced than I was at 18, but I certainly wasn't, you know, going out there and eating my vegetables and reading a book every night or anything like that. And that is, in some instances, what these Major League Baseball franchises are asking their 21 and 22-year-old players to do. And granted, they get, if you've been drafted highly, you get remunerated for that kind of work. But at the end of the day, you are kind of assigning homework to a baseball player. And that's just the kind of thing they wanted to avoid by getting into baseball. So that kind of accessibility, I think, is pretty commendable in the case of Fuller. And perhaps that's something that he can take from the Orioles and put right into the White Sox system. I would imagine there's a couple of things that port over really easily and right into the White Sox bloodstream. There are going to be other things that Fuller probably wants to do differently and wants to build out some, or wants input on from other places within the White Sox organization, and are going to be built kind of bespoke to the White Sox. I'm looking forward, and we're going to put in the request to talk to Ryan Fuller here on the show in the next couple of weeks, because as important and as impactful as the hiring of Brian Bannister has been on the pitching side, certainly the hope is that after some time, Fuller can have the same kind of impact. Speaking of Fuller, or at least speaking of the coaching staff, Will Venable is our guest next on White Sox Weekly. I had a chance to talk to him at the ballpark yesterday, so for the very first time here on White Sox Weekly, you'll hear the new White Sox manager, Will Venable, when we come back on ESPN 1000.
Follow Chicago's Home for Sports on Twitter at ESPN 1000.
Welcome to White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. Celebrate your special occasion in 2025 with the White Sox party area. Reserve your group outing today to get access to top matchups and the best spaces. For more information and to secure your group outing, visit whitesox.com/groups. I'm Connor McKnight. We've got Will Venable, new White Sox manager, hopping on in just a second here. Full disclosure, we recorded this interview yesterday at the press availability for Venable at the ballpark. It's kind of nice to be back at Guaranteed Rate Field. I've enjoyed the time. You know, winter is winter. The off season is the off season. But then you get back around the ballpark and you kind of start thinking to yourself, huh, I wouldn't mind coming back here. I could use some more baseball in my life. It's been a little while. I'm a junkie. What can I tell you? I like the game is what it is. Got a chance to talk to Venable. I had a long conversation with him. We'll play it for you in just a second. But I do want to tell you that you're coming up in the second half of the show here, after we get done with this conversation with Will, talk about some of the roster moves the White Sox have made here over the last week or so. Penn Murphy is a name I think we'll all get to know, and a couple of players departing, taking their free agency, or opting rather for free agency. We'll talk a bit about some free agent targets, and we will, of course, hit some of the rumors that have been, that have had the White Sox involved in them. But without further ado, here is my interview with White Sox manager Will Venable, taped yesterday at Guaranteed Rate Field. Will, in less than 2 years, you went from taking your final MLB swing to working in a front office to coaching. What was that journey like, and how does it inform where you are right now?
It was an amazing journey, and I had a lot of help along the way. It was great to be able to connect with Jed Hoyer, and he gave me the opportunity to get there in the front office and just expose me to the Cubs organization and really a professional organization from a side I hadn't seen before, and really set me off on my course to become a coach and eventually go to the Red Sox and the Rangers, and now here as a manager with the White Sox.
What were your goals when you started in the front office, and how have those changed for your post-playing career?
Really, my goals in the front office were just to learn about how an organization worked behind the scenes. It was just something that was foreign to me, and I was pretty transparent going in that I wanted to have an exploratory role, and was lucky that Jed gave me the opportunity to do that, and became pretty clear that I wanted to help players on the field, and they were able to help me do that.
One of the things you ask players sometimes is, like, if you could go back and talk to 13-year-old you and tell him that he made the big leagues, what would that 13-year-old person say? It's different with you because your dad played, and I imagine your perspective is a little changed. What would 13-year-old Will say to current Will, knowing that he's an MLB manager?
What happened to your basketball career? That's what he'd ask him about.
Your jump shot completely broken?
I was so dead set on being an NBA player from when I was in kindergarten, I can remember thinking about it all the way through my high school career. And then once I got to college and realized that the guys that I was not able to guard were going to be first rounders in the NBA, kind of let me know that maybe I needed to shift gears.
What kind of input did your dad have on your playing career, your baseball career, and your coaching career? You talked a lot about him in pretty cool ways in your introductory press conference here a few minutes ago.
Yeah, he's been amazing. I got the benefit of watching him when he was a player and I was a young kid running around a clubhouse. Then I got the benefit of him just being my dad and instilling the values in me that I carry with me today. And then he was my coach in the minor leagues. He was my hitting coach in A-ball and AAA. And to have his guidance and help has just meant everything in my career.
What kind of a player in the clubhouse were you? And how does that inform how you will, kind of manage the emotions, the relationships of a clubhouse? Kind of that off the field sort of managerial role.
Yeah, I think it's just about creating relationships with people and just being positive, and at the same time, to be able to speak up for the things that you know are important and be direct and honest with people and ultimately hold people accountable to the expectations that we all have is something that's extremely important, too.
One of the things that I've been told is a very difficult and important part of being a manager is bullpen management. So first, is that still something that ranks up there on the top of the list? And second, what is your strategy and who will help you kind of form that strategy of bullpen management over the coming months as we get to spring training?
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of the biggest challenges for a manager and something that, going to take a lot of pride in and certainly important part of my job, but also something that I'm going to need a lot of help with. And, Ethan will be part of that process. And, as we round out our staff, there's going to be other people involved in that too. It's really going to be a collaborative effort at the same time, knowing that, in game, the buck stops with me and I'll be making the decisions.
And I would imagine, given the fact that you will likely be a young bullpen, you're going to find places to challenge some of those young pitchers. What goes into finding some of those spots, if that's going to be the case, and who do you determine who you can challenge and who you need to kind of pull back a little bit on a given day? I know we're down the line a little bit, but that'll be part of it.
Yeah, that nuance is important, and that understanding of who these guys are and where they're at and how they match up with the opposing lineup is important. And those are going to be things that we're going to meet about and talk about on a daily basis, and we'll come up with our plan for the day, knowing that that plan is not going to work, and it's not going to – I shouldn't say it's not going to work. It's not going to unfold how we expect it to, and we're going to have to adjust. And ultimately, guys are going to have to step up, and we're going to figure out who is best used in what spots.
How did you and Chris kind of go about the process of and have the conversation of hiring Ryan Fuller as the director of hitting for the organization now? What sorts of assets does he bring organizationally, and how do you kind of feel your job melds with his now from a top to bottom kind of perspective?
Yeah, pretty early on in the process of me getting the job, Getz was transparent about the fact that he thought that adding someone in this type of role in a director of hitting role was something that was attractive, and that Ryan was a great candidate. And then when that came to fruition, we started talking more about what that looks like and his oversight and being able to align the organization on some of the things that are important to him and that are currently in place is going to be huge. And at the same time, his support for Marcus and our hitting department is going to be also very important.
White Sox fans are obviously going to be looking for signs of growth as we get into spring training and into next season. It was a tough year last year, as you know. Where would you direct them to look? To whom and for what should they look for growth and signs that this is moving the way that you and Chris obviously have designed it to go?
This is a really good question. I think that I'd probably be able to answer that more once we have a clear understanding of the roster. And I think we're still very much developing, one, obviously the roster, but also, the type of players we have and the type of team we want to be. And, I think at the same time, there's going to be things that are important to us going out and executing plays at a high level, going out and competing that we, can expect from the beginning.
Are there parallels to the White Sox pitching staff as it stands right? A lot of youthful, promising guys. Have you been in spots before, Red Sox or Rangers before, where you've got kind of this younger group that you want to push into the right spots? Is any kind of parallel to that that you can think of?
Yeah, I don't know about entire groups, but along my career, you see individuals and bullpens that you know, maybe are less experienced. But, you know, I think that it's a really good opportunity for these guys. There's going to be opportunities to step into to high leverage roles. And really every role on a major league roster is important. And, you know, these guys will be interesting to see how they fit into that group.
Garrett Crochet grew into one of the best in the business last year. Obviously, his name is out there. How do you view your role right now this winter in terms of being part of that conversation, regardless of what may or may not happen here in the coming months?
You know, as far as, you know, the roster construction, you know, that's Chris's job and his group. And, you know, I'll be excited about whatever group we have, and we'll do our best to go out there and win ball games with that group. You know, as far as potential moves, you know, that's all Chris.
Do you have a favorite memory from your playing days? Is there like one thing that you could nail down more than anything else?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, it wasn't necessarily on the field, but, you know, I mentioned my dad, and he was a AAA hitting coach when I was in AAA. And he was the guy that tapped me on the shoulder to bring me to the manager's office to tell me that I was going to the big leagues. And to have that moment with him was as good as it gets.
I would imagine both of you have kind of like had conversations about that over the years, like since that has happened. That's like a family Christmas story that you tell over the table, right?
Yeah, we talk about it all the time. I mean, it was, you know, I think about how special it was for me, you know, probably just as special, if not more, for him. And I know he's extremely proud of me. And, you know, even to share this has been amazing with him. So I'm glad he's been there the whole journey.
How have you been shaping your role in terms of getting ready for the R&D side of baseball and talking with the players that you'll have about what that analytics department, that R&D department, comes up with?
Yeah, so it's really from day one for me as a coach, it's been about communicating with the analysts and, you know, really collaborating and working together on how to best utilize this information. And it's really a two-way street where, you know, as a coach, you have a lot to learn about the data and the models and what's going into these into this information, and then being able to offer the perspective of a player and a coach and some of the challenges of, you know, being accurate to utilizing this information. So I think, you know, for me, you know, that always continues. And, you know, I really look forward to talking to our group and having that same back and forth.
How do you think you and Chris will judge success and failure in 2025? For rebuilding teams, it's not always about the left-hand column and the right-hand column. Have you guys talked about what that's going to look like and what your expectations, or how you'll decide that you've met expectations?
You know, we haven't talked to it, about it in detail, and certainly wins and losses matter. But, you know, also I think subjectively being able to sit back and say, you know, did we create an environment that gave these guys a chance to be at their best? Do we continue to build kind of our foundation and our systems and our processes to continue, like, to support us in the short term and in the long term? And then did we make our players better? Did our players perform better and continue to grow and continue to develop? So I think there's going to be a lot of measures for us.
We'll appreciate it. Best of luck in the coming months, and we'll see you in spring training.
Thank you so much.
Again, big thanks to Will Venable for his time at the ballpark. Looking forward to hearing him a whole lot here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I would imagine that the pregame show with Len and Will is going to be a good one for all 162 next season. When we come back, we'll dig into some of those rumors that we were talking about earlier. The White Sox have their name in the papers, as they say, so we'll talk about what they're talking about when we come back on White Sox Weekly.
This is Chicago's home for sports.
On app.
The ESPN Chicago app.
In HD.
FM 100.3 HD2.
And of course on AM.
ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. I'm Connor McKnight. Just finished up our first interview here on the show with new White Sox manager Will Venable. It's awesome to be able to talk to him for the first time. We talked to him yesterday at the availability at Guaranteed Rate Field. He made the rounds, went through the car wash, and we're happy to be part of the car wash, I suppose. Oh, by the way, White Sox fans, customize your 2025 season with the new 10-ticket all-access pack and get access to opening day in the Crosstown Series against the Cubs, starting at only $224. Pick the number of games and seats that work for your schedule. To purchase, visit whitesox.com/flexpack. By far, my favorite moment of the interview with Will Venable was I didn't realize. I mean, I knew that his dad, Max, obviously a major league player in his own right, was a coach of his at points during his minor league career, but I did not know that Max was the guy, his dad, Max Venable, Will Venable's dad, was the guy that got to tell Will he was getting the call to the big leagues. At the time, Max was his coach, Will was in AAA, and when the organization decided that Will was going to get the call to the big leagues, they asked Max to do it for him. So that was that's a super cool moment. I can only imagine how awesome that is to remember every now and again. I mean, they have to have brought it up at some point in the car. Max was there at the press conference yesterday at Guaranteed Rate Field, and at some point on the ride there or the ride back or walking around town this weekend or something like that, one of them had to look at the other and say, "Hey, remember when I got called up to the big leagues and now I'm managing a baseball team? It's absolutely crazy." That's a very cool thing for the Venables to have in their baseball family. Quite a baseball family, too. A couple of the things I want to get to here with the White Sox, a couple of moves the White Sox made here in this last week, pretty much right after last week's show. I think it was as early as Monday or Tuesday, if memory serves. The White Sox let go, or rather granted free agency to two relievers that we saw work to pretty good effect at points over the last couple of years, and brought in a new arm in Penn Murphy. We'll talk a little bit about Murphy and what he brings to the organization in a second. But the two guys heading out on free agent assignments or going to free agency, I suppose the White Sox could offer a contract to either Matt Foster or Jimmy Lambert, but they were arbitration eligible and got non-tendered, essentially offered them their free agency. They took it, and they're going to be looking for different jobs. Lambert and Foster are both early 30s. And, you know, at times, Lambert, who had transitioned from a starting role with the White Sox, you remember he got a couple of starts. They did not go well, and then transitioned to a bullpen role and got the velocity up a little bit, was able to pitch fairly effectively in parts of two different seasons. And then really, you know, last 2 years, really an ankle injury with led to some other issues in his shoulder, it sounded like, really set him back health-wise. I hope the best for Jimmy Lambert. I was really intrigued by some of the stuff he was able to do out of the bullpen for the White Sox. Was pretty effective, especially when he was hitting the strike zone, was able to kind of work guys in a pretty interesting manner. Shoulder issues, though, really kind of ended his year in August last season. He would have been on track for a salary a little over $1 million, and for a guy that's, you know, for a guy that's going to be a middle reliever, you know, probably at best, that kind of money for a guy that's coming back off that injury, where the White Sox can really take some chances in the bullpen, whether that's with young pitchers in the organization or by going outside in cases like Penn Murphy or signing some free agents in. They've got a chance there to either develop their own potential long-term solutions or, you know, kind of work the flip market, right? Whether that's Penn Murphy or whether that's another reliever they're going to bring in, like you know, John Brebbia last year, which did not work out, but that was the idea. If you can bring a guy in that can pitch some leverage situations for you, maybe you flip him for some prospects at some point, the deadline. That's how this works. That's where the White Sox are at this point. Foster kind of falls into the same situation. Came back from Tommy John surgery that he had in, 2023. Pitched a little bit with the White Sox in 2024. Didn't see the velo pick back up later in the season last year. That's an issue with Foster, a right-hander who's really good in 2020. I mean, shoot, he was part of the reason the White Sox, this is a pretty big reason, the White Sox were as good as they were in 2020 and were able to get into the postseason, having been dispatched by the A's in the first round of that expanded playoff format in the pandemic season of 2020. But whether it was the fastball at the top of the zone or the changeup that enabled Foster to throw to both righties and lefties pretty well and kind of manage platoon splits, it looked like he was going to be, you know, potentially a guy. Not a back-end solution necessarily, but a dude in that bullpen, and that just, you know, because of injuries did not materialize, and some underperformance in 2022 did not materialize the White Sox the way the White Sox and I'm sure Foster would have wanted. Like both guys and hope for the best. Again, both were slated to probably have arbitration salaries around $1 million, and that's just not the kind of money the White Sox are looking to spend, especially when they can spend those. And it's not so much about the money. It's really much less about the money than it is about the roster spot itself, right? The idea that you can take some chances with some high velocities and bad control or great breaking stuff and need some help with a fastball or just some weird-looking relievers that come at it from a different angle that give you a bit of variability in that bullpen, and also are guys that can reestablish some sort of track record that they've already had in Major League Baseball. That gives the White Sox more oomph in that bullpen, as opposed to, you know, guys where they kind of know where their health is at, where their velo is at, kind of feel like they know where their ceilings are at, perhaps, and are ready to move on to a different spot. So, Penn Murphy comes out. He's a right-hander, 6'2", 195 pounds, born in Nashville, went to Santa Clara University, a 33rd-round draft pick in 2018, and he burst onto the scene a little bit late, in a late bloomer, 28 years old in 2022, and he was really good for the Seattle Mariners that year. A 2.99 earned run average in 69 and a third innings. He struck out 76. He walked 18, had an ERA plus of 1.24 and a FIP at 3.10. So not much disparity between the FIP and the ERA, which you love to see, especially for relievers. The WHIP, walks and hits per innings pitched, under 1. For Penn Murphy in 2008. 2023 was good in 14 innings, but Tommy John surgery, UCL repair, was the issue for Penn Murphy, and he has bounced around a little bit as he's tried to rehab and come back healthy. Let's see, take you through the transactions. In October of last year, he was selected off waivers by the Mets from the Mariners. Then in November, the Braves took him off waivers from the Mets. He hit free agency in November last year, signed as a free agent again with the Braves, was released by the Braves, selected off waivers by the Astros from the Braves in March of 2024, and has now been selected off waivers by the White Sox from the Astros in 2024. Last year, Murphy only threw a third of an inning, and it did not go well. He gave up, four earned runs in a third of an inning in A-ball at Fayetteville. It's not even worth, you know, looking into one way or the other. He's trying to come back from injury. He's a low-slot right-hander, doesn't throw hard, has some interesting breaking stuff to go along with it, and honestly, this is, you know, kind of the calling card for what Brian Bannister and the White Sox pitching side of things is trying to get done. He wants different looks out of that bullpen and really wants to, provide his manager, provide the White Sox with a whole bunch of different angles around which hitters have to kind of search for answers. He's got three options, it looks like, which allows the White Sox to be more flexible on the roster side of thing, and that's because it's taken him a long time to get back and healthy from that arm or from the elbow issue. He's, you know, obviously a little bit older, having broken into the big leagues at 28 in 2023. He is 30 and will turn 31 in early May, but a guy, again, with options and some track record and kind of a funky angle that helps him work around some velocities that might otherwise not be great. James Fegan of SoxMachine.com did a little reporting here, and this is worth noting. Sometimes I forget to check this myself when the White Sox make moves like this, you know, picking guys up off waivers or that kind of thing. The 40-man roster right now is at 37. And you got your Rule 5 draft coming up in middle of November. I think it's the 18th or the 19th, something like that. Prospects or minor leaguers who have had a certain amount of service time in the minors need to either be placed on that 40-man roster or they are subject to the Rule 5 draft. If a team, and the White Sox have done this a couple of times in the last few years, but I'll just remind you, if you take a guy in the Rule 5 draft, he must stay on your big league roster or on the major league injured list if the guy is hurt the entire year. Otherwise, you have to return him to the team from which you drafted him in the Rule 5 draft. Now, at 37 from that 40-man roster, there are still a number of decisions that the White Sox have to make about guys they want to bring back. Frankly, guys that they either will or won't tender. We talked 2 weeks ago about the White Sox situation at first base with Andrew Vaughn and Gavin Sheets, both of them in arbitration. And, you know, given the way that the last couple of years have gone for both guys, I don't know that the White Sox are going to have the desire to bring back both guys. Nicky Lopez is on that 40-man roster and due for a pretty good number. I think something around, you know, $5, $6 million is what MLB trade rumors have him projected for. I would imagine the White Sox are ready to move on at the very least from that number in arbitration if indeed they don't non-tender him and then perhaps work out some other deal. I know Nicky enjoyed his time back in his hometown of Chicago. So, you know, some different options there, but certainly more players than just the ones I mentioned that the White Sox will have to make a decision about, which could drop the 40-man roster now at 37 to something closer to 30 and allow all sorts of different moves to make for the White Sox as they kind of bring in guys to get different looks, get back in the right track, you know, bring in guys that are, you know, flip candidates for the White Sox in 2024. In 2025. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the potential free agent names that are out there for the White Sox. And that's right, there could be a free agent or two added by the White Sox next year. We'll tell you what some of the experts are talking about when we come back on White Sox Weekly.
We are talking White Sox.
This is White Sox Weekly.
If you missed the show, we put the podcast up on the ESPN Chicago app. So listen on your time.
White Sox Weekly. ESPN Chicago. Chicago's home for sports.
Closing it up here on White Sox Weekly, I'm Connor McKnight. Just a couple of minutes left here in the show, but we got to talk about some of the free agents the White Sox might be interested in 2025. Sox fans, sign up to become a White Sox insider for updates on the 125-year anniversary celebration next season. Get all the latest updates on games, promos, breaking team news, and other exciting Sox content delivered free to your inbox. Visit WhiteSox.com/insider today. MLBTradeRumors.com is a fantastic resource, especially in the offseason and at the deadline. They do kind of what their URL says they do, but they do a whole lot more as well. They rank the top 50 free agents out there in baseball. Juan Soto is number one, no surprise. And then they've got, you know, some of the writers making predictions as to where some of the guys will land. And the White Sox were mentioned for three different potential free agent signings. One of them, we'll go through all three here quickly, Hee-Sung Kim. In the KBO, not Ha-Sung Kim, although we are going to talk about him. Hee-Sung Kim, a second baseman, played for the KBO last year, the Kiwoom Heroes this last season. Hit well, .326 average, .383 on base, .458 slugging percentage, 11 homers, and his strikeout rate was about 11%. Not a lot of power, but good bat to ball, good defense. He has played some shortstop, but has primarily been at second base the last 3 years. I'll read you just a little bit of the write-up here from MLB Trade Rumors. It says, while he doesn't have the same upside that Ha-Sung Kim brought to the table when he came over to the Padres, he's a plus runner, strong defense, high-end bat-to-ball skills. There's a broad range of outcomes, they write, possible with this player, with Hee-Sung Kim. However, it's tough to make a whole lot of money as a second baseman in the free agent market if you're not pounding a ton of home runs. I would imagine this is why that some of the writers are predicting the White Sox could be interested in Kim, is because they've got a second base spot open. Guys like Montgomery and Ramos and Vargas, I mean, that second base isn't that spot. They could do this with a guy like Kim and kind of set that spot for a little bit and still keep it open or still keep the option available to them to flip that player if it works out for him a little bit like they did with Eric Fetty. The next guy needs a little less explanation. It's Jose Quintana. He's ranked number 31 on the top 50. He was good last year. He made 31 starts, 170 and a third innings, a .357. certainly, you know, didn't walk too many. 8.8% is right around league average. Ground ball rate, a little bit better than league average. Lower strikeouts than he usually does, 18.8%. He takes the ball and can eat up a lot of innings. And quite frankly, with a White Sox rotation that's going to be very young next year, we'll see exactly how it looks, but it's going to be young. They could use some innings, and Jose Quintana is a great teammate and a guy that, you know, knows how to get it done at this point in his career. A good run in the postseason with the Mets. It's entirely possible that another team wants him as their veteran 4 or 5 kind of guy, and he wants to go there at this point in his career. But you can absolutely understand why the innings would be appealing to the White Sox. The last one on here is actually Ha-Seong Kim. He is 29 years old. He's got a shoulder injury that will make him unavailable for the beginning of next year. He's played short. He's played second. He's played third. His managers have loved him. A good stolen base threat, 60 for 74 in steals over the last year, and a 76 percentile sprint speed. Average hitter at the plate, a guy that you could play at a whole bunch of different infield spots. And I think when you're thinking about what you'd like to add on the infield from Chris Getz's perspective, I would imagine that a veteran who knows how to handle his business defensively at a couple of different spots would be toward the top of the list as you try and ready the rest of the infield for Colson Montgomery, for Brian Ramos, for Miguel Vargas. You know, that kind of thing could be really settling for White Sox manager Will Venable. You know you can just write down Kim's name in the lineup, or, you know, whatever veteran infielder, defense kind of first sort of guy that you like, because he can take care of his business and you can find the right spots for those younger players for the first couple of months in the bigs. Those are the names on MLBTradeRumors.com. Thought they were fairly interesting. We'll dig a lot more into free agency and the potential upcoming trade of Garrett Crochet. The rumors are out there. We'll be chasing them on White Sox Weekly all winter long. I'm Connor McKnight. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next week here on ESPN 1000.